Blog Talk Radio. Silo Wealth Advisory is the Mindful Money Company. Our investments screen over 5,000 companies across the globe for their environmental impact. We think it's important to consider how your investments can benefit you and society without sacrificing returns. Visit us at silowealthadvisory.com and check out our free 60-second retirement solution. For all your investment questions, call Jeff Bogart at 855-757-7452 or email Jeff at jeff@silowealthadvisory.com. Now, here's Jeff with the Mindful Revolution.
Hello, everyone. This is Fadia Ali Baskin stepping in for Jeff Bogart. Once again, I'm so excited to be guest hosting the Mindful Revolution today. We have an exciting guest today, Dr. Terry Walls, the creator of the Walls Protocol and Walls Paleo. But before we go into that, I'd like to mention that Jeff Bogart is with the Mindful Money Company with Silo Wealth Advisory. And if you need to if you're looking for somebody to help you with your investments and to create a sustainable portfolio, contact Jeff at jeff@silowealthadvisory.com. Today's show is going to be about a person, an individual who's become a successful author, a human rights activist, and someone who is not afraid to be controversial. Her mission is functional medicine, and her way of handling medicine has helped her battle her own issues with MS. Thank you for being on my show today, Dr. Terry Walls. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you.
Yeah. Could you please take the it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Could you please take the time to introduce yourself to the audience, tell them a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa. I'm also a physician at the Iowa City Veteran Affairs Hospital, and I'm a clinical researcher. I came to Iowa in 2000, and just as I came, I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, and that was on the basis of a history of visual dimming about 13 years earlier, a new problem with my left leg. In the workup, I had lesions in my spinal cord and abnormal spinal fluid. Now, I knew that within 10 years of diagnosis, one half of the people newly diagnosed with MS will have difficulty with fatigue, causing them to have to quit working. One-third will have problems walking, needing a cane, walker, or wheelchair. And I decided to get a second opinion from the best MS center I could find in the Midwest, which was the Cleveland Clinic. They looked at my MRIs, examined me, and said, yes, you have relapsing remitting MS, and they suggested I take a disease-modifying drugs, which I did. And so over the next 3 years, I had just one acute relapse involving my right arm, treated with steroids, and everything came back. So had I been in a drug trial, that would have been called a success with only one relapse in 3 years. But I had steadily declined over those 3 years. I now had worse fatigue. It was difficult to sit up because my belly and back muscles were weak. And I had converted into what was called secondary progressive MS. And now I was taking chemotherapy. I still declined. Then I took Tysabri, one of those new biologic drugs, still declined. And then I was put on Cellcept, which was somewhat less toxic. Gave me a lot of sores in my mouth and made me look sort of gray and ashen. That was when I decided I had to read the science myself. And I would also begin reading a lot of mouse studies about MS and other diseases with shrinking brains like Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's. And I would begin experimenting based on what I was reading about what was happening with mice in terms of vitamins and supplements. And I slowed my decline, so I'm very, very grateful, but I'm still declining. By 2007, it's I'm walking very short distances using two walking sticks. I have severe fatigue by 10 in the morning. I began to have problems with brain fog. That summer, I lost my phone, had to replace my phone three times because I lost it. I was losing my car keys. And I knew that I would probably in the next 6 months likely have to finally quit working because the VA and the university had been extraordinarily generous redesigning my jobs multiple times to help me continue working. And it was that summer that I discovered electrical stimulation of muscles, something athletes have been doing for years. And I worked with my physical therapist, and I started doing that along with my exercise program.
And your exercise program.
I'd been an athlete before going off to medical school. I had competed nationally in taekwondo. And so once I'd been diagnosed with MS, I knew that exercise would be critical to maintaining strength as long as possible. So I had exercised every day. When I couldn't run, I put in a pool and began swimming in my home, and I swam and lifted weights. But by the summer of 2007, I could no longer swim because of coordination problems, so I did a very simple water aerobic kind of thing. And all I could do was about 10 minutes. If I did anything longer, I was flat out exhausted and just couldn't go to work. So I had a very limited exercise program. I started doing electrical stimulation. So I quit swimming so I could do the electrical stimulation. And at that same time, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. And they had a course, Neuroprotection, with a lot of lectures and synchronized audio and a big notebook and a textbook. So I'm going through this in the midst of my brain fog, and my kids are laughing because I'm going over the material, the same material again and again. But when I'm done, I have a longer list of vitamins and supplements, which I start. And then about a month later, I'm thinking, you know, I should redesign my diet to get this list of nutrients from the food that I ate. Now, I'll step back just for a moment and make the comment that I'd been a vegetarian for about 20 years, and my neurologist in 2002 at the Cleveland Clinic had told me about the work of Ashton Embry and Lauren Cordain. And so I was introduced to their work on the paleo diet and the science they had behind why they thought it was a better diet for people with autoimmune problems. And so after a lot of prayer and meditation, I had went back to eating meat. And so I gave up all grain, all legumes, and all dairy. And so that was a huge radical change for my diet. But I continued to decline. Even though I was declining, I decided to stay with it because at least I felt like I was doing something. So now get back to 2007. I have a longer list of vitamins and supplements, and it occurs to me that I should redesign my diet so I could get these nutrients from the food that I ate. And so that was some more research, and I went to the Health Science Library, and they couldn't really help me find that. So I went back into the Internet and found food sources that I should stress. And this would ultimately be what I now call the Walls diet. And within the first month, I could tell that my brain fog was much less. And I was walking with one cane in the hospital. And in 3 months, I have quit using my tilt-recline wheelchair altogether. And I'm walking with a cane. At 6 months, I don't have a cane. And at 9 months, I get on my bike after a family meeting, I might add, where my family decided whether or not it was safe for me to bike ride. And my wife decided that my son would jog on the left, my daughter would jog on the right, and she'd follow on the bike. And I biked around the block, and we're all crying and sobbing because I hadn't biked in 6 years.
So how old were the kids at this point?
You know, so when I was diagnosed, my kids were 5 and 8. And so in 2007, they would have been like 16 and 13.
Oh, teenagers. That's so touching. Okay.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it actually was very cute. When I got my bike, I'd gone out to get my bike. I was going to take this bike ride, and my son saw me, ran out, grabbed the bike. And he's very protective, like, oh, Mom, you know, we've made all this progress. We don't want to risk you getting hurt on your bike.
Yeah.
And then after I made the bike ride, you know, we're all crying. And it's the first time that I begin to think, like, you know, maybe recovery is possible. Because even though I had, you know, I'm dramatically better, because I had so accepted that when you have secondary or primary progressive MS, the decline is steady. There is no recovery. That I really hadn't entertained what was happening, that maybe recovery might be possible. And so at that point, I began to feel like, okay, no one knows. I'm making new ground here. It might be, with enough time, that you know, I could repair and be normal strength and endurance for a woman of my age. And then, so I start biking. You know, at first it's just around the block. That's enough to tire me out. And over the next 3 months, I'm biking more. And I do a 20-mile bike ride with my family. Now, mind you, I bike 5 miles and I lay down and rest, and then I, after 10 minutes, get up and bike another 5 miles. So there are plenty of breaks, but to have completed a 20-mile bike ride, you know, felt miraculous. And that really changed how I thought about life. You know, it certainly transforms me as a person. It transforms me as a physician because now I'm thinking about disease and health very differently. And it would change how I practice medicine. And I would begin teaching the public, doing some public lectures about my story and the power of changing the diet to improve health. And then I started giving lectures here at the university, some interesting departments. And my chairman of medicine asked me to work with my treating physicians to write a case report, which we did. And once that was in, then he pulled me back into his office and said, now I want you to write up a little clinical trial and test the protocol that you've created in others with progressive MS. And so he helped me find some other more experienced clinical researchers, and we designed a trial. I got funding to get it going, and we ran a trial with 20 people. Where we copied what I did as close as we could, again, with people who have progressive MS, so there was no expectation that there's any spontaneous recovery in that group. And their disability level was really quite significant. Needing cane to walkers, and, of course, severely fatigued. And so we had a dramatic reduction in fatigue, the largest that's ever been reported, and this is in the most disabled population that's ever been studied for fatigue. And then we have several more papers that are in development, one that will be talking about the changes in mood and thinking ability. We have another one talking about the changes that we saw in walking ability. And when that paper gets published, we'll look for a journal that will let us house the videos before and after, so people can.
How are your patients doing right now? Are they improving? Are they experiencing what you experienced with, was like slow improvement?
So, in my clinical trial, I would say about half of the folks had really noticeable improvement in their walking ability. Nearly everyone had noticeable improvement in energy levels, thinking ability, and mood. Changing motor function really requires willingness to do a lot of intensive physical training, every bit as rigorous as what we'd ask a world-class athlete to do. Because when you're that debilitated, to come back is really a lot of hard work. And some people are able to do that, some are not. And the folks who couldn't do it, is it because they don't have that athletic spirit, or is it because their disease, there's still some level of activity that prevented them from being able to work out? You know, hard to know. But, you know, in a disease where you expect a 15% decline in the walking ability every year, even holding someone flat is a dramatic success. And the fact that we had about half the folks have clinically meaningful improvement in walking ability.
I think that's
really quite remarkable.
It's an awesome success story. It's unrealistic to think everybody's going to have the same experience, and it really is based on individual will. Wouldn't you say?
Well, that's certainly a big part of it, and we're asking people to do a lot. We take away foods that most of us are addicted to, you know, sugar, white flour, gluten, dairy, and we ask them to eat things they may not be familiar with, vegetables. We ask them to eat lots and lots of vegetables. And so that's a big lifestyle change. Then we ask them to meditate. And, of course, no one's a meditator. And we ask them, people who are completely exhausted, to exercise every day. By public health colleagues would say getting people to do any one of those things successfully would be huge, to get them to do all three. Most researchers would never ask that. And we had, I think the mean vegetable intake at entry was 1.5 servings, and the mean vegetable intake at the end of 12 months was 8.5 servings. Now, the public health folks feel like anytime they can get people to still be in having one more serving of vegetables per day than they had at baseline, that would be considered a huge success. And so for us to have increased it, you know, by a factor of almost 6 is stunning success.
So there's more success with the vegetables than with the fruit?
Well, we stress the vegetables. We minimize the fruit. We really want people to have vegetables. A little fruit is okay, 1 or 2 servings a day. But vegetables are much more important.
Well, I mean, how much of this diet is a common sense diet?
Well, I would say for most Americans, this does not feel common sense, because I'm taking away grain, and they've been indoctrinated that whole grains and grains are a big part of their diet. We're taking away dairy, and again, for most Americans, they would think dairy is an important part of their diet. Hopefully, most people know that we should be eating vegetables and would not be surprised when we say we really need you to eat 6 to 9 cups of vegetables every day. And most dietitians, when they hear people are removing food groups from a diet, such as take away all grains, all dairy, they call it a fad diet and caution people against it. But we, when we designed this diet, we analyzed a week's worth of menus and recipes to confirm that when you follow the diet, we don't have any nutritional deficiencies. And in fact, we have 3 to 6 times the vitamin and mineral intake of the average American in terms of the NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Survey, that's done by the NIH. So
the
our
food
diet
pyramid,
is very sound.
The food pyramid I've always found to be kind of off and unrealistic. I mean, how can we correct this? You know, I mean, do we need to relook at all of this for people in general before it gets so bad that you've got you're dying?
let's talk about the food pyramid. The food pyramid is in the dietary guidelines are made by the Dietary Advisory Committee that is appointed by the Department of Agriculture and I think the Department of Health and Human Services. There's a terrific paper from U.S. Food and Law Journal that looked at, over time, how many of the appointees have a financial relationship with the food industry. And so since the inception of the Dietary Advisory Committee, there's been a steady increase in the number of scientists who have strong financial ties to the food industry. If you compare the advice from a governmental body that has a requirement that the scientists cannot have a financial relationship with food industries or agricultural industries, those dietary advisory groups come up with recommendations that look much more like lots more vegetables, a modest amount of meat. They may or may not include dairy. If they have grain, it would be a limited whole grain amount. I would also make the observation that when we, as we evolve the U.S. dietary guidelines, there's never a study to validate the effectiveness or the efficacy, the effect size of actually following those dietary recommendations to say that they're good for you. However, if I have dietary recommendations, in order for me to say anything about them, I'm required to have two trials at two sites, so that cost about $5 million each to be able to make a claim to say the Walls diet is good for diabetes. And I can say the Walls diet is good for yourself. I can't say it's good for your diabetes or good for MS officially because the FDA is not, we've not done the $5 million studies. And, of course, we never will. Those kind of studies will probably never actually happen, unfortunately. But I think it's very ironic.
I was listening to the radio. And there's a research done that Mediterranean food is really good and helps with all of these diseases. And I'm like, did we really need to do research on that? I'm not really sure we needed to. It's very clear that the diet of the Mediterranean countries are just, fruits and vegetables and healthy grains and nuts. I mean, that's always been true. I just don't understand why they had to do a research study on that to prove that.
Well,
because to me, it's common sense.
In order for us to say that eating more vegetables and less sugar and white flour, we need to have some scientific studies. And so there are some interesting studies comparing the Mediterranean diet to like the American Diabetic Diet or the American Heart Diet or the diet following the U.S. dietary guidelines. In the Mediterranean diet is superior. Now, it's my opinion that the diet that I've created would beat the Mediterranean diet as well.
It sounds like a great diet. It's not a competition.
We have to study it to know. The other thing I'd say is we already know that because humans have evolved over 100, 200,000 years. And we've had many, many clans all over the world eating the food that was available locally fresh in season, of course organic, as their societies evolved and grew. So we know there are many, many diets that achieve strong, lean bodies that are capable of living to 60 and 80 years of age with full function of their body and their mind. We also know that some societies didn't thrive as well because they didn't have such great food choices available to them.
So that makes sense. It really has to depend on the region that they're in.
Right. There is no one, only one diet that we can live off of. Our cells are adaptable. We can burn fat. We can burn carbs. We can burn protein and manufacture the missing a lot of the missing stuff, although not everything. Some things we absolutely do have to eat.
What that does really mean is, with all the good food, you still need the exercise. You really, really
well,
do.
Well, if you want to thrive, absolutely. Because exercise is needed to make nerve growth factor so our brain stays healthy and doesn't just shrivel up. We need exercise to keep the inflammation molecules properly balanced. If we're not exercising, my bones and my muscles will be replaced with fat. My tendons and ligaments holding my skeleton together will become less and less strong. And if I'm not challenged by thinking, learning, having to be resourceful, my brain shrinks. So we need physical exercise.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you were telling me before we got the show started that you practice yoga. Can you tell me, since we do kind of talk about that, what do you think is so special about yoga? Because you talked about meditation being important. We know that's a component of yoga.
Well,
the deep breathing on a cellular level, can you talk about what that does for your body?
Well, yoga does many, many things that are incredibly helpful. Just from the physical exercise, it does a lot of strength training and balance training. So it's really potent anti-aging medicine. With the breathing, that can improve the oxygen levels at the cell. It can reduce the sympathetic hyperadrenaline state. It can improve the parasympathetic or that reparative state. And so it's very normalizing in terms of our activation of our autonomic nervous system. It's normalizing in terms of activation of the adrenal axis when we have that fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
And as I had said earlier, it does improve the oxygenation level of the lungs, which then will go on to improve oxygenation for the cells. So,
well, I have another question for you. Yeah, I'm sorry to cut you off. Yeah, it's just that I've dealt with my own health issues, and I came to realize, like you, that diet was going to be the thing that was going to save me. And of course, I've always been into exercise, but really paying attention for me, fruit is helpful. I don't have a gallbladder, so eating fruit is good for my functioning of the GI tract. So, if the GI tract is not functioning, and you're backed up, does the brain back up? Is the brain now not functioning?
So there's a lot of information that there is a tremendous amount of neural tissue in the guts going to our bowels, our stomach. And there's tremendous communication between the gut and the brain. Many of our neurotransmitter molecules, we make many more of those same molecules, such as serotonin, in the gut than we do in the brain. And there's also lots of information that the bacteria that live in our bowels are critical to our overall health. And for those who are having a lot of struggle with constipation, which is rampant in America, that's a reflection of having the wrong bacterial species living in the bowels and not enough of the lactobacillus family and not enough of the bacteroidetes phyla or group of bacteria. So your guts, your bowels are huge. If you're constipated, that's a sign that there's a lot wrong in your bowels. And a lot of that will be inadequate vegetable and plant fiber in the bowels.
So if you're up, you're raising the intake of the vegetables, you're helping yourself.
Absolutely. You want to raise the intake of the plant fiber. You know, because we push that so hard, we want everyone to have 6 to 9 cups, preferably 9. If you're really petite, fine, 6 may be okay. But all of that plant material feeds the bacterial species that are so critical for the health of the host, that's you and me, and to have a healthy mix of bacteria in our bowels. You know, if you're not pooping twice a day, we need to improve the mix of bacteria in your bowels.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are not pooping. And if you're not pooping, you're not thinking clearly. And, you know, and I wonder why we don't talk about it. You know, I feel like this is like a taboo topic, and I'm not sure why, you know.
Oh, we're
unless you're talking
to
your grandma. She's talking about it, you know. But,
I used to laugh at my elderly patients. They're so fixated on their bowels. Now I realize, you know, they were right. The bowels really are what's so important, and we have to be sure that people are pooping. And you don't give them laxatives to poop. You give them plant fibers so that we're feeding the right bacteria. And then, of course, we'll have nice bowel movements.
And you'll have healthy skin, and you'll feel good, and you'll be a happier person.
And your brain will work better.
Yeah,
you'll have healthier weight. All sorts of good things will happen.
You know, there's a movement now to, you know, really accept people in their different forms, and I'm all about that. But what concerns me is that there's a disconnect between realizing that when you have a great deal of weight around the abdomen, that really affects your overall health, that it attacks your body. So there's got to be an understanding that it's not about having an ideal image. It's about having a healthy body and lifestyle and
healthy
feeling
body,
good about yourself.
Healthy brain.
Yeah.
So if you've got that big belly, the belly fat called visceral fat is a very active hormonal organ, pumping out molecules that will drive up inflammation that will dramatically increase the risk of all sorts of inflammation-related diseases like diabetes, heart disease, autoimmune problems, early dementias, people having problems with their thinking ability in their 50s and even in their 40s. The cost of medical care for that individual is, you know, markedly higher, and we're talking 2 to 4 times higher. And if that person is a mom, the pregnancy complications are much higher, the outcomes for the child much worse. So there are health consequences and economic consequences when we become overweight and obese. That's
let me tell you
a separate issue from whether or not you accept that person as a person of worth and value.
Well, exactly. And we in this world, in our specific country, we don't value our citizens. And we mean, you know, I would actually have a separate show about this, but I think I'm going to bring it up with you because I think it's relevant. Is that we like to call ourselves a first world country here in America, but in reality, we have people living under third world conditions. So until everyone is living under first world conditions, we don't get to be a first world country. And I believe our government to be very abusive and very intrusive in our privacy. We have a huge amount of people. If you go to Detroit, I live in Michigan, you're going to find a third world country. And you'll find that in many big cities, areas mm-hmm. where people are just, they don't have access to good food, they don't have access to good health care. Well, they're struggling, you know, they're down, they're heavy, you know.
So let's talk about Detroit, Atlanta, Oakland. These are cities that have urban deserts where there are large parts of the city where there is no food within a mile. So it's hard to get food, it's hard to get vegetables. But there is also the beginning of community gardens, urban farming. And what I would like to see, and could be hugely beneficial for these communities, is the resurgence and the creation of urban farms, urban gardens, community gardens. All these empty lots could be converted into urban farms, community gardens, which would transform those communities in huge ways, get the young people much more excited about eating vegetables and eating real food, and provide employment and entrepreneurship opportunities for these communities. So, you know, when I think of the cities that have been blighted and their is this economic downturn, what an opportunity we have through the urban agriculture, community gardening, to reclaim the and rebuild these cities in a very vibrant way.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. We have an opportunity here, and we really should not let it go. But I just feel like there's so much greed, and we sit and talk about the money it takes to help turn things around and help see people receive the proper information. It's just kind of sad, you know, that it has to be that way. You know, and I guess
I think we have to help, you know, with public policy to create economic incentives. We'll still have to make a good business case for the urban farmer, for these small community gardens, for the micro farms. But public policy could be put in place to make it to rezone, to allow community farming to happen, community gardens to happen. So there's a role for public policy and to help because there is a rapid growth in farms consolidating to, you know, multi-thousand acres, but there's also an even more rapid growth of these micro farms, of the 5-acre, 3-acre, half-acre farms that are basically large, intensive community gardens. And I find that a very exciting change. And that type of activity can be transformative in communities to help these young entrepreneurial farmers set up not only in rural America, but also in urban America. This would be phenomenal.
Well, I mean, people are being pushed around like nothing else right now. We have people pushed into the city and also people being pushed out of the city simultaneously. What's going to happen with all these people? It would be amazing if what you're saying could actually come to life, because it's just such an amazing opportunity. If you think of Detroit, they have the Detroit Housing Project. They're knocking down houses, and it's going to take them a long time to get all of these burnt-down houses gone. But, I mean, it would be an amazing opportunity to see the youth get involved in this and have greenhouses and have outdoor gardens. I mean, we have space. So,
yeah,
you know.
Ron Finley in L.A. Started planning community gardens and is helping to transform L.A. Through the community gardening and urban farming movement. And, of course, we need more Ron Finley's. But it is beginning to happen. And when I talk about, when I talk to the community and to my medical colleagues about, you know, the Walls diet, need all these vegetables, and, you know, I talk about how my vets don't have money. So we talk about gardening. We talk about farming. We talk about foraging, hunting, fishing. And it's helpful for us all to be mindful about talking to our patients about gardening, putting things in container gardens, hanging off their decks, or in their apartment windows, to have people take more ownership to do everything that they can do. And I talk about you got to start cooking at home. If you have someone else cook for you, you're going to get the lowest quality food that's the most harmful. And it doesn't cost more to cook at home. You can make red beans and rice very inexpensively using your crock pot. It doesn't take you more time. And to reteach the American children and the American families that the patriotic thing to do is to reclaim your health by learning how to cook again and to cook with real ingredients, with vegetables and beans and rice and meat. You don't have to be spending more to eat healthily.
You know, I think that what you're saying is on point, and I'm not really sure what needs to happen in our government to shift it. I do think that people are being paid. Money is too much of an issue there. I mean, to me, we don't really have a public sector. We have a private sector, and that's it. The private sector has pretty much owned everything right now because everything is about the money and is about business.
We've put our government officials up for sale when the Supreme Court ruled that spending for political speech is, you know, corporations can spend whatever amount they want. And so the amount of money that our politicians raise means that changing public policy for public good will become increasingly difficult. Public policy will be probably more beholden to whoever's paid the most for the election, basically. That means it's up to us, mm-hmm. the public, to solve this. But I'm actually very optimistic because as long as we have the internet and we have social media, we have shows like this radio show and the blogs, it's much easier to publish your experience. The public is getting disenchanted with the pill for every ill, with the medication, the surgeries, that's not really seeming to be creating health. And more of the public is talking about their experience with the figuring out that diet and lifestyle is how they began to be well again. So actually, I'm quite optimistic that the public will get this ahead of the government, will get it ahead of the medical community, that we have to cook our own food, that we have to begin growing our own food, that we will be figuring out how to get more food into our yards and lawns and into our apartments and into the empty lots in our communities. So I'm very optimistic. The government can't solve this. I'm not interested in wasting my time trying to get the government to solve it, but I am very interested in educating as many people as I can through as many venues as I can that diet and lifestyle is how we became ill, and diet and lifestyle is how we could choose to become well again.
Well, on a more personal matter, it has been almost 4 years since your son, Zach, who was then 19 years old, bravely stood up in front of the Iowa House of Representatives and defended gay marriage and his family. Zach proudly proclaimed, "The sexual orientation of my parents has had zero effect on the content of my character." And his speech instantly went viral and became YouTube's number one political video of 2011. That's awesome.
You know, and so, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. He had 20 million views for his 3 months.
That's amazing.
Which is really pretty cool.
I mean, really, do you think that government or, you know, election okay, let me see. Democracy by representation is really the best way to go about it. I mean, we have a Clinton and a Bush on the ticket right now, and I, for one, have been there, done that. I have the hat. I have the T-shirt. I don't need this again. And I'm wondering how out of control the situation in the government really is.
You know, again, because of our Supreme Court decisions, if we go back far enough, you can see that when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations were people and gave them as much authority as they did, that also set in motion that corporations no longer had to look after the public interest. They were beholden only to their stockholders. And that, you know, has gotten worse and worse and worse. Now we have our Supreme Court that has said corporations can spend however much money they want to spend in the political process, which makes it more and more difficult for our government to be as responsive as it should be. Having said that, as difficult as that is for us, many, many countries have governments that are even far less responsive than ours. I'm not as knowledgeable about public policy, so I can't comment on that too much, other than say I see that it will be very difficult to change public policy around food. So I'm not looking for the government to solve this problem. I'm looking to create a movement at the grassroots level, because it's up to us to solve it. It's up to every family to learn how to eat for and live for the best health for their family and their kids. And now
and that's challenging.
It's
what you're talking about is getting the message to people who are closed out from hearing the message. And we have lots of corruption in the public school system and the government, and just it's all over because it's all about the dollars. You know,
but we also have social media. We have the internet. My son's YouTube video, you know, went to 20 million views. The YouTube video of me telling my story, My Need Your Mitochondria, has like 2 million views on it. And that has driven, I'm sure, hundreds of thousands of physician-patient conversations where the patients went in and said, well, what about food? What would happen if I ate 9 cups of vegetables a day? Can I do that safely? And that has shifted the conversation, and it's given many families tools to begin changing their health. You know, and I've heard from thousands and thousands of families that they've gotten their life back, either because they read my book or they've watched that YouTube video and fundamentally changed their approach to food.
And so I agree with you. I think the power of the internet, we haven't even begun to see what's going to actually come out of that, because I think we're going to see huge amounts of meaningful revolutions, meaningful by that we won't need another one, because there's going
absolutely.
To be correct change. Yeah. So I'm excited.
Mm-hmm. In 2008, when I had my personal transformation and I changed how I practice, so now I'm talking to my patients about vegetables and taking B vitamins and fish oil. And my physician colleagues were like, very alarmed by this. I had to go visit with my chief of staff, explain what I was doing, take down my scientific papers. And then he would ultimately become a champion. And when I would talk about vitamins and food to my vets, they didn't know what to think. And very few of them had ever considered that food would be important. So that's 2008. Now, 7 years later, 2015, the VA had asked me to run a clinic based on my principles. We call that the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic. Huge success. I have other physicians from all around the campus come sit in my clinic in our classes to see what we're doing. The university is so impressed with the research that I'm doing they made a Walls Research Fund. And, you know, the first year I was the biggest donor to that fund. Then the next year we're doing a little bit better. And this year we're having some major donors make huge contributions to get me going in the next level of studies. And, you know, I'm going around to the university showing our research. The basic scientists are calling me, wanting to be in my lab because, one, they hear that I have money from these private donors. And people are so excited by the research data that I'm showing. I'm capturing the imagination of my scientists. I'm capturing the imagination of the public as well. And, you know, when I'm talking to patients in our lifestyle clinic and the traumatic brain injury clinic, many of the patients are now saying, well, you know, my cousin, my nephew, my niece, my granddaughter, they changed their diet and their health dramatically improved. I've been wondering if I need to give up gluten. Yeah, and so the public is more
receptive. This leads me to want to ask myself, and before, I do want you to answer what I'm about to ask you, but I do want you to tell our listeners, ask and answer it, how they can get a hold of you, because time is quickly running out. But,
okay,
you know, why can't we raise our standards for food? Why do we have so much McDonald's? Why do we have so much Wendy's? What is with the fast food
thing? We have
that
because the public support that. That's what we bought. That's what we wanted. It tastes good. It's cheap. It's easy. When we eat it, it stimulates our pleasure centers of our brains. And every society, once exposed to this, abandons their traditional food and goes into the sugar and white flour diet. It's happened over and over again. Now, when the elders wake up and say, no, I'm also optimistic that we can change McDonald's and Wendy's. They want to make money. And when they realize that the way for them to make money is serving vegetables and sandwiches that are wrapped in a collard leaf, they'll do that.
Yeah.
That would
be amazing.
They will do that when there is enough economic pressure and demand for them to do that. So what I can tell people is, The only thing that you and I control is the choices that we make. I can't even control my kids. Ultimately, you know, they're adults. They're going to make their own choices. But I can control mine. And so my choice is going to be, I'm growing as much food of my own food as I can. And when I go out to eat, I'm going to get my burger wrapped in lettuce or kale or collards if I can. And what I've seen now over the last 5 years, more restaurants are having meals that are more appropriate in my eyes, you know, vegetables and meat, and we don't have the white flour sugar as the only option. So we can all change that, but we do it with our own individual choices.
So set a good example, and the world will change.
We all have to become the change we want to see.
You know, I live in a community that's down right now. You know, and you could say that about most of Michigan, and maybe most of the world, if we really ask ourselves. So when I go, I don't see anybody running in my community. So when I go for a run, I feel like them watching me run changes them, and it changes my world. You know, and I know a lot of people are giving back to their community, and it's for free. You know, and it's to change their world because they get it. And it might seem kind of self-centered, but you know what? It's okay. I think there's nothing wrong with wanting to have people who are content living around you. So before we move on, could you please tell my guests how they can contact you if they want to learn more about the Walls diet and just everything that you are?
We have a website, terrywalls.com, T-E-R-R-Y, Walls, W-A-H-L-S.com. So go there. We have lots of information. Sign up for the newsletter. Then you'll get more info. I do not have a private clinic outside the VA. I do periodically have in-person seminars. And so if you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get links for those events when they occur. We have the book is a great place to start, and for many that's enough. If you want more support, we have that on the shop pages in that we have 30-day quick starts, and I'm making more online programs and memberships so people who want more support can have that. But again, no private clinic for me. I do teach classes here at the VA, and we do have in-person seminars. And from time to time, I have clinical trials that are recruiting. I don't have a trial that's recruiting right now. When we do have a trial recruiting, we will put that up on my webpage.
So if there's one thing that you want the listeners to take away from this interview and something that you really want to give them as a message, what would that be?
Cook meals at home and eat more vegetables.
How important is organic?
You know, if you can afford it, great. If you can't afford it, just do the best you can. But cook at home and eat your vegetables.
That's just what Mom would say.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you have provided a wealth of information and inspiration today, and I just want to thank you. And, you know, just keep on doing your work, and I agree with you. I think you have a reason to be optimistic because of people like you in the world, and I'm just very grateful that you're on our show today. And if there's any other information that you want to pass on before we end in a few minutes, please feel free.
Hail to the kale. Grow your own food. If you have sunlight, you can grow things in your windowsill, on your deck, or in your yard. If you don't have sunlight, you can grow mushrooms and sprouts. You can grow your own food. Cook your own food at home from scratch. Vegetables and meat are what we should be eating. Lots of vegetables and a little bit of meat.
And create community gardens, right? And be a part of creating a community garden.
If you've got access to sunlight, you can grow your own food. And if it's just in your windowsill, you can still grow lots of your own food.
And raw vegetables are going to be the ideal way of consuming them?
They can be raw or cooked. But the key thing is we have to eat vegetables. We must eat our vegetables.
Well, I agree with you. I agree. What you put in your food, in your mouth counts. You know, that moment on the lips, left hand on the hips thing, that's not a joke. And I also would like to add exercise. Do as much as you can. You know, listen to your body. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness has to do with you listening to your body. So I just thank you again for being on the show. You've added to the mindfulness of the world by sharing your story. Keep it up. And I'm going to say farewell and have a fantastic evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Yeah. Bye-bye.